Moving on in time, we come now to the mid-19th century. No more royal mistresses for the moment, but instead we have the analysis by Jean Elizabeth Petersen at the University of Rochester, outrageously flirtatious, Alexis de Tocqueville on Women and Democracy in America and France. I'll tell you a little bit about Jean, whom most of you know anyway, but it's always good to remind people that she is an associate professor of history in the humanities department of the Eastman School of Music at the University of Rochester and a member of the history department there. She's the author of Legislating the French Family, Feminism, Theater, and Republican Politics, 1870 to 1920, published in 2003. The editor of a special issue of Historical Reflections called War, Occupation, and Empire in France and Germany in 2014. And she is currently completing the manuscript of a new book, a very interesting analysis of the group called the Union de la Vérité, the Union for Truth, intellectuals, educators, and activists of the French Third Republic. Her additional work on the history of feminism in France and beyond includes articles and essays on figures as various as the French novelist and social reformer Louise Comtin, the Polish pacifist Maria Chelyga, and the American suffragist Susan B. Anthony, on whom she tells me she's done several lectures lately, including one in the house of Susan B. Anthony in Rochester. Today's paper is the result of her recent participation in this NEH summer seminar on American democracy with Alexis de Tocqueville as guide that was sponsored at the University of Virginia in July of 2016. Jean.
Well, thank you, Karen, for that lovely introduction, and thank you, Christine and Tracy, for organizing this fabulous panel. And especially since we're in Washington, D.C., I want to say thank you to the National Endowment for the Humanities, which sponsored the summer seminar on Alexis de Tocqueville, and thank you to all of you for coming. In 1831, the young French aristocrat Alexis de Tocqueville and his best friend Gustave de Beaumont traveled from the France of Louis-Philippe to the America of Andrew Jackson. While their ostensible purpose was to research and write a useful report on prison reform, their actual purpose was to establish some distance between themselves and the new July monarchy until they could decide how to further their fledgling legal careers in the challenging political climate of post-revolutionary France. In addition to visiting prisons, speaking to prison wardens, and interviewing prison inmates then, they also took copious notes on every other aspect of American life that they could observe as they traveled up, down, and around the United States and Canada, from New York in the east to Michigan in the west, from Quebec in the north to New Orleans in the south. Shortly after they returned to France in 1832 and co-authored their report on the penitentiary system in 1833, Alexis de Tocqueville published the two volumes of his famous Democracy in America in 1835 and 1840. Many scholars have written on Tocqueville's comparative views of French and American democracy, but not nearly as many have taken an interest in his comparative views of French and American marriage and family life. Those who have analyzed his views on women have typically focused on a series of questions about his portrayals of American women, whether they are positive or negative, descriptive or prescriptive, accurate or completely inadequate. But for the purposes of this panel on the history of French views about the Gallic singularity, I would like to shift our attention from the complex question of how Tocqueville viewed American women to the more broadly comparative and equally complex question of how Tocqueville ranked the relative social situations of American and French women in the 1830s. The title of my paper, Outrageously Flirtatious, comes from the text of an especially intriguing letter that Tocqueville wrote to his sister-in-law, Emilie de Belleisle de Tocqueville, in November 1831. "I've already roamed this world quite a bit," Tocqueville wrote home from Ohio. "I have seen people in positions different from ours, but no proof that anyone is fundamentally better off." Here, for example, I see reduced versions of all the ugly political passions that our revolutions have made so glaring in France. But I will stop there for fear of lapsing into considerations of high politics, philosophy, metaphysics, economics, and ethics, from which I would be unable to extricate myself without putting you to sleep. In any case, I was saying that America is no better than France. Let me take, for example, what is called in the style of Madrigal, the fair sex. I confess that from a certain point of view, this country is the El Dorado of married men, and that one can almost certainly find perfect happiness here if one has no romantic imagination and asks nothing of one's wife other than to make tea and raise one's children. In these two respects, American women excel. They are reasonable people who stick to the basics, confine themselves to their teapots, and never leave their homes once they have uttered the famous yes. Yet, despite this incontestable advantage, which I freely grant, I often find myself asking whether ultimately, note I say ultimately, they do not bear a prodigious resemblance to European women. I beg you, do not look at me as a woebegone philosopher, but hear my reasons. My first and greatest reason is that before marrying, they all have a flirtation that surpasses our best efforts in art this regard. There is no question of love here in the strict sense, and that is a great boon for the tranquility of society. I have not heard of a single person hanged or drowned anywhere in the Union since the Declaration of Independence. There are no fights. There is no talk of impetuous actions. Young women are perfectly free to choose, and yet their choice always falls on the man whom the family notary would have chosen had he been consulted. As you can see, I am impartial, yet it remains true that they are outrageously flirtatious. So Tocqueville continues on for several more paragraphs, and then he comes to the conclusion of his discussion with Emily this way. As travelers invariably remark, the fact is that married women in America are nearly all languid and feeble. I am not far from thinking that they are all ill, afflicted with repressed flirtatiousness, which I considered as the other title for the paper. Why not? Don't we daily see men turned as green as meadows from repressed ambition? I have said enough to prove that, all things considered, it is still better to live in France than in America. So Tocqueville's suggestion that American wives are ill with the effort of repressing their outrageous flirtatiousness seems to serve here as an indirect way of praising the socially permissible flirtatiousness at the supposed heart of the French sex gender system instead. And for the purposes of our panel on the history of assertions and arguments about the Gallic singularity, his letter is especially interesting in at least four different dimensions. First of all, it indicates the extent to which Tocqueville, like many social observers before and after him, believed that he could use the status of women in any society as a key to understanding that society as a whole. When he put his comparative case to Emily, he went straight from the assertion that America is no better than France to a discussion of what is called the fair sex. When he published the first volume of Democracy in America 4 years later, he credited American women with shaping American mores, and when he published the second volume of Democracy in America 9 years after the letter and 5 years after the first volume, he included four successive chapters on raising girls in the United States, how the traits of the girl can be divined in the wife, how equality of conditions helps to maintain good morals in America, and how the Americans understand the equality of man and woman. Second, then, Tocqueville's letter to Emily highlights the importance that Tocqueville consistently placed on marriage as the chief event that governed the parameters of a woman's life, whether in the United States or in France. His entire discussion of American women here, for example, revolves around the differences in their behavior before and after the decisive moment when they have uttered the famous yes. Yes, I will marry you. In the second volume of Democracy in America, he expanded on this theme when he opened his longest chapter on women and girls by observing, quote, "Although girls in America are less restricted than they are anywhere else, wives submit to greater obligations. A girl turns her father's house into a place of freedom and pleasure. A wife lives in her husband's home as in a cloister." Third point. The letter suggests the extent to which Tocqueville's discussions of marriage and family arrangements in America always rested on implicit or explicit comparisons to marriage and family arrangements in France, and sometimes also in England. The American democratic practice of letting young women walk out freely with young men, for example, seemed striking to Tocqueville chiefly because it contrasted with the French aristocratic practice of isolating daughters from society in convent schools. The American expectation that married women would confine themselves to the home, similarly, seemed striking chiefly because it contrasted with the French expectation that marriage would be the moment when a woman might come out into society instead. Fourth and last, however, and this is where I find the letter the most interesting for our study of French ideas about the so-called Gallic singularity, Tocqueville's letter to Emily not only compares the United States and France, but also concludes that France is better. And on the one hand, that might not seem surprising in the context of the other papers on this panel, the work of Mona Ozouf, or many of the other episodes in the long transatlantic history of debates about whether Latins or Anglo-Saxons are better at love, sex, and marriage. But it is surprising coming from Tocqueville, because when he published the two volumes of Democracy in America less than 10 years later, he famously and insistently came down on the side of the United States instead. In his chapter on raising girls in the United States, for example, he focused on the ways in which an American girl could learn to grow up, quote, thinking for herself, speaking freely, and acting on her own. Although he admitted to some ambivalence about the American system, when he reported that he himself, quote, had often been surprised and almost frightened by the singular skill and pleasing audacity with which young American girls marshaled thoughts and words while deftly negotiating the shoals of a sprightly conversation, he nevertheless criticized the French for giving women what he called a timid, sheltered, almost cloistered upbringing, and then suddenly abandoning them without guidance or assistance to the disorders that are inseparable from democratic society. When he moved on to his chapter about how equality of conditions helps to maintain good morals in America, similarly, he compared and contrasted American democratic marriage practices and European aristocratic marriage practices, only to conclude that American practices were the best. Begin by noting, he observed, that if democratic peoples grant women the right to choose their husbands freely, they are careful first to furnish their minds with the enlightenment and their wills with the strength that may be necessary for such a choice. Whereas among aristocratic peoples, the girls who furtively escape from paternal authority and fling themselves into the arms of a man whom they have not been granted either time to get to know or capacity to judge are without such guarantees. So American voluntary marriages, he continued, were a recipe for the kind of deep, regular, and quiet affection that gives life its charm, and European arranged marriages, by contrast, were a recipe for unsuccessful elopement, spousal estrangement, compensatory adultery, and all the violent and capricious emotions that disturb and shorten life. And finally, when he got to the discussion of how Americans understand the equality of man and woman, he took the opportunity to praise the United States over France for several additional reasons that he also connected to the democratic nature of the American sex gender system. He started out by criticizing an unidentified series of people in Europe who I wish he had identified, perhaps the French and British utopian socialists of the 1830s, because they were the sex radicals of the day, although his description doesn't really sound quite like them, because he describes them as confounding the various attributes of the sexes, claiming to make man and woman into creatures not only equal but alike. And criticizing these unnamed, radically egalitarian opponents gave him the chance to praise Americans for understanding the importance of maintaining sexual difference even in a democracy. He explains, Americans believed that because nature, there's that nature question again, had made man and woman so different in physical and moral constitution, its clear purpose was to assign different uses to the diverse faculties of each. No country in the world has been more persistent than America in tracing clearly separated lines of action for the two sexes, or in wanting both to proceed at an equal pace, but along two permanently different paths. American women might display a manly intelligence, an energy that is nothing less than virile, as he put it, but they still confined themselves to private life, stayed away from activities that required physical strength, generally maintained a very delicate appearance, and always remained women in manners. In short, he said Americans believed that every association needs a leader in order to be effective, and that the natural leader of the conjugal association was the man. They did not deny him the right to direct his helpmate, and they believed that in the small society consisting of husband and wife, as in the larger political society, the purpose of democracy is to regulate and legitimate necessary powers and not to destroy all power. And he concludes his discussion by contrasting virtuous American women with adulterous European wives, American men's respect for women's minds with European men's contempt for them, American men's general disapproval of seducers with European men's acceptance and enjoyment of a sexual double standard, and American lawyers' insistence on treating rape as a capital crime, with French juries' refusal to convict men for raping women at all. Having thus compared American sex roles, family structures, and social attitudes with a series of general European and specific French ones, Tocqueville closed with a ringing endorsement of the American system and its benefits for democratic American women and men alike. He says, if someone were to ask me what I think is primarily responsible for the singular prosperity and growing power of this American people, I would answer that it is the superiority of their women. So we have certainly come a long way in 9 years from Tocqueville's initial letter home to Emily, where he asserted that America is no better than France, and it's still better to live in France than America. And I've been trying to figure out what accounts for the difference between the minor letter and the major work. So I have thought about timing, I've thought about genre, I've thought about audience, I've thought about tone, but I think the most satisfying way to understand the continuity and contrast between the personal correspondence and the published work may be to use it as a way of highlighting the ambiguity of his larger political project. Democracy in America has been open to many competing interpretations in the near century since it appeared. Conservative admirers have focused on Tocqueville's staunch defense of states' rights and local institutions against federal programs and centralizing systems. Liberal admirers have focused on his worries about the tyranny of the majority, his criticisms of American race relations, and his anxieties about whether or not democracy itself could survive. Although I read Tocqueville as a qualified optimist about the future of democracy myself, I have to note that he ended the second volume of his book by acknowledging not only his hopes, but also his fears. So Tocqueville may have looked at his present day and set his face resolutely forward to the democratic future, but I think he could not help regretting certain aspects of the aristocratic past. And the result is a paradoxical comparative thinker who eventually rejected the Gallic singularity, preferred the American sex gender system, hailed American women as the foundation of American democracy, and married a British woman himself and spoke English with her in the privacy of their home, and yet insisted that sexual equality was not the same as sexual sameness, prescribed a special form of democracy in which men were in charge of politics and women were in charge of mores, and ultimately seems to have contradicted every single one of his assertions about the central importance of American women when he devoted the vast majority of the pages of Democracy in America to the study of relations among American men. Thank you.